Hello and welcome to the Atomic Timekeeping Podcast, a podcast about the most accurate clocks ever built. I think that as this podcast evolves, I'm also going to talk about other things that I find interesting and as far as gadgets and electronics. And I think that if you're interested in atomic clocks like I am, you might be interested in some of these other things too. So we'll see how it evolves. But as we begin, I think there's a lot of things we can talk about as far as atomic clocks. For this first episode, I'd like to simply introduce myself. My name is Greg Anderson, and on the net, I've been known as Elmer for quite a while. Long story there. But I want to tell you a little bit about why I'm interested in these atomic clocks and why I want to talk about them. Generally, I won't want to talk about myself on these podcasts, but for this one, I just want you to get to know who I am. Now, I'll tell you first of all that I went to elementary school and junior high school in the 1970s, and mostly in the Chicago area. So, it gives you a little bit of an idea of my age and where I'm coming from culturally. One of the products that was big in the 1970s, that really didn't exist at the beginning of the decade, but was extremely common by the end of the decade, was the household calculator. In case you don't remember the 1970s, wow, we started off, you know, maybe some people had an adding machine in their house, but for the most part, you know, we just didn't have this stuff. But as these products were introduced to the market, prices came down, competition heated up. Soon they became very affordable, very common. A lot of companies putting out little pocket calculators or at least little desktop calculators that you could have in your home. The very first models of calculators around had LED readouts, or in some cases, I think they called it a fluorescent display, so it was sort of a green LED readout. But this digital readout with the light-up numbers was something that was new and exciting that we really hadn't seen before. Something else that came out about the same time as these calculators started really flooding the market was the digital clock. Most people didn't have digital clocks in their homes before 1970. If you had an alarm clock radio, it probably had a little analog clock built into it. And that was at the beginning of the 70s. By the end of the 70s, most alarm clock radios had a digital display. And just, you know, the market completely changed. And then the other thing that at the same time became such a common thing was the digital wristwatch. I remember the first time I ever saw a digital watch. I hope I'm remembering this correctly, because I think it was a television program called The Magician, with Bill Bixby as this magician who was also a private investigator on the side who solved crimes and brought justice to the world. interesting idea for a show. So I think it was that show. I just remember a scene where a guy is about to make a phone call and he looks down at his watch to see what time it is. And it was a digital watch. And I'd never seen one before, but it was just the coolest thing I had ever seen. This guy, this character, was wearing a digital watch on the show. I didn't know at the time digital watches were extremely expensive. The price came down a little bit by the time I ever saw a digital watch at a store, you know, with my own eyes. I think it was like $200 for a little LED digital watch. And those of you who don't remember this, the LED watches, well, the first models out, they had metal cases and it just looked like a, you know, kind of a regular watch with a metal band and everything like that. But the face was just this dark, dark red blank face that remained blank most of the time. In order to see the time, you had to push a little button on the side of the watch, and then the numbers lit up for just a few seconds, and you'd see the time. Wow. But most of the time, that face was just blank. Eventually, you know, these things started to come down in price, and I think the real revolution was when a company called Texas Instruments started making little plastic digital watches, and the prices came way down. I think, you know, maybe for about $20 now you could have a digital watch, and so they became quite common even among my friends in junior high school, guys with digital watches, and I thought they were so cool. even though they usually didn't display the time. You know, you had to push that button on the side. And I didn't really like the plastic watches. I thought they looked cheap. And, you know, we really hadn't seen that on the market before. Watches were always, you know, some form of a metal case, maybe a leather band, usually a metal band, but, you know, not a plastic watch. I just thought that was tacky. So I didn't like those Texas Instruments watches. But I wanted a digital watch, and I think by the time I got one for my birthday, my parents went out and they got me it was a metal watch, but it had an LCD digital display, and I hadn't really seen this before I had one. I thought the LED was neater than that, but by the time I got my LCD digital watch, I realized, well, that was really the cool thing to have, because it displayed the time all the time. You didn't have to press a button for the digits to light up. I didn't know, but apparently LCD technology had made great leaps in the 1970s until finally the power consumption was not so great. And by the late 70s, LCD digital watches just completely overtook the market. Nobody was making LED watches anymore. The LCD was the thing. I remember my first LCD digital watch. Okay, so this was a National Semiconductor brand name. It was a four-digit display, so it would display the time. Now, if you push a little button on the side of the watch, it would then display the month and the date. You know, the four digits would display that. And if you push that button again, it would display the seconds. And then, you know, push it again, it goes back to the time. Just the coolest thing ever, right? A digital watch. And here I am in junior high in the late 70s, my digital watch. Well, because it could display the time right down to the second, I realized that I really wanted to set this watch to the right time. And this became a little bit of a challenge because in my life, there were two standards for the time. There was the television stations. So, for example, if your favorite television program comes on at 7 o'clock, where I was, every television station seemed to be synchronized. 7 o'clock was the same time on whichever channel you chose. 7 o'clock, turn on your favorite show, and it was starting right then. So I got the idea, well, there must be some definitive time that all these television stations are using, and so I like that. But when I would go to school, the time was different. It was off by, you know, a couple of minutes. I don't remember the exact amount. So when the bells would ring at school, you know, it was not exactly according to the time that the television stations were keeping. So I had to decide, well, am I going to set my clock according to the bells at school, or am I going to set my clock to according to, you know, the television station? So I think I just compromised, and probably during the school year, I would set my little digital watch according to the bell system at school. And then, you know, when school was out, I would go ahead and set it to synchronize with the television stations. And so, you know, that's what I did. But I was aware that there must be this definitive time, the correct time. And I was always interested in knowing that and keeping my digital watch, you know, synchronized. I was becoming a clock collector as a teenager, so I had other clocks around the house, and I tried to keep them all synchronized as well as I could to the right time. Well, then, I'm going to skip ahead to the 1980s, because that was the next real significant thing in my pursuit of accurate time. And this story has to do with another product that sort of belonged to a specific decade, and I'm talking about something we know today as the boombox. They weren't really called boomboxes at first. There wasn't really a name for them, just, you know, self-contained portable stereo system. Well, that's a name that really didn't stick, but eventually all the different names that people call these things somehow boombox stuck, and that's how we know them today. But boomboxes didn't really flood the market until the early 1980s, and then they were all over the place. And the companies that were making boomboxes, there wasn't really a standard at first of what features that your average boombox should contain. You know, they were all different sizes. Some had better speakers than others. Some maybe had an AM/FM radio with a cassette player. Others maybe had a cassette recorder. Others maybe had a cassette recorder with optional external inputs, so you could plug microphones into it or plug a turntable into it. There were just, you know, all kinds of different features. There was no real agreement on what the consumers really wanted in their boomboxes. So the first boombox we ever got in our family had AM, FM, and shortwave radio. So this is one of the features that wasn't very common on boomboxes, but ours happened to have a shortwave radio receiver in it. And I didn't really know much about shortwave radio, but I quickly learned, this is kind of neat, actually. Shortwave radio, it operates at frequencies that are able to reflect off of the atmosphere and back onto the ground, and then back off of the atmosphere and on the ground. And what this does is it means that you can receive shortwave radio stations from thousands of miles away. And that's pretty neat. I started listening to international broadcasts, maybe, you know, BBC World News, or stuff in different languages, or, you know, all these interesting foreign accents, and it was neat. So, you know, a teenager with some curiosity, just scanning around your shortwave dial late at night, and you had to be real precise tuning in these obscure stations, and you listen and try and hear what's going on there. Had a lot of fun with that. But one thing I discovered on the shortwave radio, and I quickly understood what this was. Let me play you a sample of this radio station that I found. It sounded something like this.
At the tone, 20 hours, 7 minutes, coordinated universal time.
And I knew that this then from the National Institute of Standards and Technology must be the definitive time of day, the correct time. I had been told that there was something called an atomic clock, which was the most accurate clock ever built. And, I quickly figured out what I was listening to on this radio station called WWV was a regular announcement of what time it was, correct right down to the second. And so I thought, this is great. Now I'll never have to worry about setting my digital watch again. I can turn on this radio station and get that thing set right down to the second. I'll always be accurate. That was fun. Now, it was only a little bit after I discovered this radio station that I started working at a movie theater as a teenager. And by now I was in Southern California in the Long Beach area working at this movie theater. And of course there was a clock in the lobby, and I made sure that I set that clock to the correct time as precisely as I could that corresponded with this time I was getting from WWV. And after a while, I started working in the projection room of this theater. I was one of the projectionists. So I was the guy who'd thread up the film and start the film. And we had 6 screens, so I had that going on. And, well, you can imagine, I started the movies on time. And I was very proud of myself for starting the movies right on time. In fact, this is how precise I was. We had these automated systems, so most of what was going on there, I didn't have to be standing right there next to the projector while it was running. I really just had to worry about maintenance, cleaning, and just threading up the projector each time a new show was going to begin. And so then once the projector's ready to roll, it just sits there, you know, the film all threaded up, and then you just have to push a start button. Everything from that point is automated. It starts the motor. It strikes the lamp. It turns on the sound system. It dims the lights in the auditorium. All these things happen in sequence, and then finally your first frame of film is on the screen. And I knew that the time between my pushing the start button and that first frame of film appearing on screen was 8 seconds. So you can imagine, if we had a movie scheduled to start at 8 o'clock, I would go up there, stand next to the projector, and at 8 seconds before 8 o'clock, I would push the start button, and that movie would come on screen at exactly 8 o'clock. I don't know if anybody ever realized I was doing this, as far as our customers realizing it. But I figured, you know, there were some military installations around. I figured maybe there's some people in the military that, in the course of their military operations, have synchronized their watches to the Naval Observatory clock or something like that. And so there must be someone in the audience at some point who's able to recognize when they see the lights start to dim that, wow, that guy just started the movie at exactly 8 o'clock, you know. Chances are nobody really took note of my extreme precision there, but I was always proud of myself for starting the movies on time. So anyway, I want to skip ahead then to the 1990s, and I was becoming a clock collector. I had a lot of interesting clocks that I liked, but one thing that always bothered me was that I didn't have a clock that was perfectly accurate. So I was always having to just adjust my clocks here and there. And, you know, daylight saving time was a big deal because I'd have to change the time on, you know, dozens of clocks that I had in my collection. I remember going to a clock shop and asking somebody there, you know, is there such a thing as a clock that can set itself using these atomic clock broadcasts? And they actually had one. It was a clock that was made more for industrial purposes because there are clock systems that they might use in factories or schools, universities, whatever, where you've got one master clock and then every other clock in the building and throughout the different rooms of the building or around the campus or whatever, those clocks are all wired in to the master clock. And then all of those clocks throughout the building or the complex display the same time as the master clock. And they had something like this at this one clock store that could set itself by receiving the radio signal from the WWV broadcast. And I thought, oh, that's a great clock. Can I get one of those? He said, well, you know, they're actually made for industrial purposes. They're very expensive. They're really not practical for what you want. And I said, well, that's too bad. And he did assure me, though. He said, I've been to the conventions, and I'm familiar with what the industry is doing in the whole clock-making industry. And he said, just, there are some people working on this, so just be patient. There will be a clock soon that will be available on a more affordable consumer level that'll be able to set itself to the atomic clock. So just be patient. And so the day finally came in 1995, where just out of the blue, I got this catalog in the mail, gadget catalog, that I don't even know how I got on their mailing list. But I was glad I was, because out of the blue, I get a catalog from a company called Lifestyle Fascination. They've since gone out of business. But they have all kinds of little gadgets in this catalog. And right in the middle there was this Yunkan's Mega Clock. It was a clock that could set itself according to the atomic clock in Colorado. And I realized, well, this is it. Finally, after all my waiting, I've got a chance to buy this clock that can set itself and remain accurate using the atomic clock standard. It was about $200 in this catalog, just a little clock that sits on your mantle that's, maybe 8 or 9 inches tall. And I thought, well, that's kind of an expensive clock, of course, but how could I resist? So that was it. In late 1995, that's when I bought my first what we call radio-controlled clock, which could set itself. And another neat thing about it was that it would make the change for daylight saving time by itself. So that was fun. You could just leave it running. And until the battery wears out, you never have to adjust it at all. You've got a clock that's showing you the correct time right down to the second. So that is a not so brief summary of my interest in the subject of atomic timekeeping. And I'll have more to say about the technology and about the products and less to say about myself in upcoming podcasts. So I just want to thank you again for giving me a moment of your time to enjoy the Atomic Timekeeping podcast. I hope you'll join me again next time when I'm going to talk about the technology that makes the real atomic clock work. And, well, that'll be fun for the next Atomic Time Podcast. Also, if you have any comments or feedback, I will accept your email. The address is atomicelmer@gmail.com. Okay? atomicelmer@gmail.com. I'll be happy to entertain your thoughts there. I may even quote your email on an upcoming podcast, so let me know whether or not you'd like me to do that. If you want to just tell me your name and where you're from, that might make it fun if I quote your email in an upcoming podcast. So again, thanks, and we'll see you next time on the Atomic Timekeeping Podcast.